Stevenson and
this is the beginning of tape number 8, Friday, September 11th, 1959. A continuation of tape number 7, conversation started this morning.
President, I want to get right back to where we were abruptly left off. That is on the question of the character of a man for the presidency. You were saying moral, and what you probably meant was character, wasn't it?
That's right. Well, a man can't have character unless he has a fundamental system of morals which creates character.
What are those?
Well, he's got, in the first place, he's got to be honorable with his associates. He's got to be fair to the people with whom he's associated, particularly with his wife and family. And he must have a reputation that his statements are to be backed up to the end. That is, his word is good. You can't, no politician is of worth anything unless his commitments, verbally and in writing, are as good as a bond would be for a bank.
Well, then I'd like to ask this one question. Throughout history, and certainly in recent European history, you have had statesmen and men who headed governments who were what might be called Machiavellian, or people who couldn't be always believed, or made sudden changes and turns. Well, that's also been true in American history, hasn't it?
Well, not to any very great extent. The principal number of those people of the character you name are behind the Iron Curtain. You'll find that the British government, the head of the British government, no matter who he happened to be, as prime minister, his background and his word and his moral standing was always excellent in the last, I'd say in the last 40 years, 50 years maybe. And the main difficulty with the French government has been not with the head of the government, but due to the fact that the situation in France was divided into 20 or 30 parties, none of which had any background which would cause them to stick with a program. And I don't think you'll find there have been so many of the Machiavellian type in Europe since the old man wrote his book.
Well, now, the question of party division in this country has been puzzling a great many people and students as to precisely what the function of each one is to be in the future. And how do you foresee the Democratic Party as it evolves in the future and the other party?
Well, one of the reasons for our good two-party system, which has worked very successfully for almost 100 years, is due to the fact that each party is made up of certain lines of thought. There are crackpot liberals, there are honest liberals, there are people who think the welfare of the country comes first, and there are people who are bent over to the other side. And some of us thought they ought to join the Republican Party and be done with it. But that same thing's true of the Republican Party. They have their lines of demarcation between various ideas of what the government ought to be, and I've come to the conclusion that's a good thing, because when the turnover is made from one party control to the other, the same pressures are on the new party who has come in control as were on the old one, because they have the same sort of a situation in their background. Although, you see, a great majority of the members of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party inherited their ideas. They didn't learn them themselves. They just got it from father and grandfather, as a result of the war between the states. And I'm very strongly in favor of a two-party system. And to keep up that two-party system, we must have all classes of people in each party. Of course, I think the Democratic Party, when it's in power, is always for the underdog. The Republican Party, when it's in power, is for the top dog, which has been amply proved in the last 8 years.
Now, there are people within the Republican Party that don't admit to that. They insist, and some of them have even tried to turn liberal. There have been liberals among the Republicans.
Oh, yes, a great many liberals among the Republicans, and I've always invited them to join the Democratic Party where they belong.
Well, do you think they're liberal by delineation or evolution? Because they certainly didn't get liberalism from their forebears, because Republicans...
No, but I think they've studied, most of them are able men, the ones you mentioned, and they have studied what the welfare of the people means. And as I say, and as I've said about several of them, they're Democrats and don't know it.
Well, are the Democrats of the South, this is the principal problem, going to stay put, join up, or press for a third party?
Well, the Democrats of the South are what's left over from the terrible Reconstruction period of old Fat Stevens, who was one of the worst old birds that ever lived in this country. And you find that the great men in the South in the present day who do their own thinking are just as interested in the welfare of the people as a whole as are the so-called liberals of the North. And eventually, when all this color proposition is out of the way in the South, you'll find we will have the same leadership in the South that we had before the Civil War.
Do you think it could be helped along or even cured by the induction into the White House of either a president or vice president from the South?
Yes, I do. I think for president or vice president, if a president from the South were to move into the White House, he'd make just as great president as one from New Hampshire or New Jersey.
Why?
Because his responsibilities, with the background that he'd have to be president, would cause him to do that.
Do you have any such persons in mind that occur to you that could have become such?
Yes, president? There are half a dozen, but I don't want to name them because it'd make all the rest of them mad.
Do you feel that way about the possibility, this is possibly for off the record, of a man of the Catholic Church becoming a president of the United States?
Well, the main difficulty with that situation has been that the hierarchy of the Catholic Church wants always to control the political operation of a government. That's the reason they had trouble in France. That's the reason they've had trouble in Italy. That's the reason they've had trouble for the Reformation, which our Martin Luther, the great man Martin Luther, gave them the best attitude that man could give them on that subject. And I have no feeling at all about the morals and dogma of the Catholic Church. But when the Catholic Church gets to a point where it's in control, the government is always against the little people, and tolerance is not considered. That's true in Spain, that's true in Colombia, in South America, where in Spain, a Baptist can't be buried in daylight, and he can't be buried anywhere but in plowed ground. Well, I wonder what would happen if this great United States of ours would prevent Catholics from being buried in daylight and force them to be buried in plowed ground. We don't feel that way here. But whenever a religious organization gets control of the government of a country, you better look out, you're in trouble. Make any difference whether it's Catholic, Protestant, or Jew.
Therefore, you feel that the problem of separation of church and state is the real issue behind...
The First Amendment is one of the best amendments to the Constitution, and that's it.
All right, sir. Now, the Democratic Party seems to have had a tradition of having a national chairman as a Catholic, and that most of the principal governors and candidates for a large office have been of that faith.
Well, idea of a chairman of the National Democratic Party as a Catholic originated, I think, probably with Franklin Roosevelt when he appointed Jim Farley to be chairman of the party. And Jim was a good party chairman. But I don't think that has any effect on what we ought to stand for in the separation of church and state. I don't think the church ought ever to control the government.
And you don't think that
I don't care whether it's Protestant or Catholic or Lutheran or Jew.
And the tradition should be amended as soon as it can be brought about. You were for that in 1952.
It doesn't make any particular difference about the chairman of the National Democratic Party or the chairman of the Republican Party. They're only the organizers of a convention that's going to nominate a president and a vice president. And it's nice to have good men in charge on either side. I don't think his religion ought to make any difference.
Well, hasn't there been a departure in the way chairmen of both parties have been conducting themselves in recent years in terms of not confining themselves to the election of a president, but making party policy?
Well, no chairman of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party is in a position to make policy. The policy of the party is made at the convention when they meet. That means that the majority of the people are represented. And when they make a policy, the chairman has to enforce that policy. And it's not his business to try to make policy when the convention is not in session.
Is it any of his business to interest himself in the candidacy of any one person?
He shouldn't. He's supposed to be neutral. He's supposed to raise the Democratic Party so it can win no matter who's nominated. And he oughtn't to have any candidate of his own to push.
Now, how do you see the Democratic Party evolving in this changing industrial age now? Everything is going to automation and the emphasis on more and more benefits for labor and more security for labor and more security for management. And where does the Democratic Party fit in that kind of society?
The Democratic Party will be what it's always been, a representation of those people who have no pull at the source of government, local, state, or national. Democratic Party will always be what we might call for the common people. And they're going to stay that way as long as I have any influence.
Now, this is still the age of the common man, is it not?
It always has been the age of the common man, only sometimes he's been suppressed.
Now, what are the Republicans going to have for their...
Can I break
claim?
In there? I'm
yes.
Sorry. What do you mean by the common man?
I mean the ordinary fellow who has a small home, a small farm, a small interest in a business, and who is trying his best to raise a family on the basis of his income. And unless his income is protected, he'd be in a bad way.
You also would include, of course, the working man who doesn't necessarily
That's the working man. That's the working man. Man on a small salary who has a small home, who's trying to raise a family. They all go together. Isn't there a difference between them?
Because you feel that basically if these people of small income have a chance to earn their income, they're the basis of the whole economic
structure.
That's right,
and they ought to have a basis of income which will give them a chance to meet the payment for necessities in what they have to have.
Would you name those as job security, home security, health security, and what other securities?
Well, they all go together. Things have come to the point where in the national setup, which has become the greatest in the history of the world, all those things must be properly protected by the government of the United States if the state governments don't do it. Some states do.
Well, do you think that this is a primary government responsibility and function?
There's any question about it.
So that the difference between one party and another still gets down to the basic securities?
That's right. And what I tried to do while I was president was particularly to have the health of the people properly taken care of, because they have invented all these various things to make people live longer and to make it easier for them to get well when they're sick. But they made it so expensive with hospitals and doctors' charges, and the American Medical Association was absolutely against a program to set up a situation where people could make a saving, and they have to be forced to make these savings so they could pay their hospital bills and their doctor bills, and they call that socialized medicine.
Well, there are all kinds of Blue Shield, Red Shield, No Shield, all kinds of plans.
Well, they
meet the problem.
They help, though. They are voluntary. Unless you make people do what they ought to do when the time comes in the cases of health and service to the country. That's the reason we had to have a draft. Why, they won't do it.
That's interesting. Now, why do you think people who are so much concerned about the health of themselves and their own have to be compelled to do what is good for them?
Because they don't want to pay the bill when it comes due. They all love the doctor when they're sick, but when they get well, to hell with him.
So that this is not a thing for individual choice or community option. You think this is a federal matter?
I thought so. I made a
still do.
Wrote a message on it, and I still feel that way.
And that's primarily because you think that health now plays such an important role in what a country can do and what a people themselves can
that's
do.
Right.
That some regulation ought to be.
People physically fit. When I got the reports on the registration for the draft in the Second World War, I found that between 34% and 36% of the youngsters were unfit for service. And two-thirds of that was brought about because they didn't have the proper medical attention when they were growing up. And that's what I wanted to cure. And now 34% of the youngsters are unfit. What do you expect from the next generation? The ones that were fit were taken in hand and shot at and killed. And those that were not fit were left back to make the next generation, and I was against it.
Well, now, how do you go about taking a free people and compelling them to do those things which
you can't compel them, you've got to convince them. And that's what I tried to do, and haven't had any luck so far, but we keep working at it.
Well, the people were convinced. A lot of people obviously understood what you tried to get them to do, but
the American Medical Association didn't believe in it because they didn't know what they were talking about, and they still don't.
Well, then how do you overcome that?
Just keep working at it, and finally, when the vast majority of the people understand exactly what they are entitled to and what they ought to have, then we won't have any trouble putting it over.
Well, you think this is one of the primary things yet to be accomplished
in our society? I'm sure of it, because health is the most important thing that an individual can have. If you go back to Jamestown and go through that old church and see the gravestones, you'll find that the average age of those people was about 35 to 40. And think what that would mean today. We'd have a population of about half what we have if the anticipated lifespan was 35 or 40. I think it's way up toward 70 now. I'm one of them because I'm 75.
Well, Mr. President, then what you feel is that just as you cannot leave, for example, pollution of your drinking water to just the voluntary will of a people, so you think that certain measures ought to be necessary and compulsory in connection with health.
That's absolutely true, because you take the situation of littering the streets and the highways in the country. Missouri had finally to pass a law which has a fine of $500 for dumping trash on a highway. I had the experience out in my own place out there where we had this 600-acre farm. I put up my brother and my sister and myself planted trees and made the place look nice. And these city people would come out and dump their trash. Well, I had two staunch nephews who served in the Second World War. They took this trash back and dumped it on the people who put it there. Well, you don't find people who are able to do that ordinarily. And now we've got the situation in line so that the trash movers ought to take care of their own trash. Now, I'm figuring on putting up a sign on my front gate to litter bugs. Please take your trash with you. Don't put it in front. I have to pick it up every morning. And while I like to take bendovers, I don't like to pick up your trash to do it.
Now, that means that to a certain degree, we will always have a little bit of police in our state?
It must be necessary because people have been, to some extent, brought up to get by with what you can instead of having a moral background that would say to them, I mustn't do this because it's wrong. And the get-by business, I think maybe originated in our military educational institutions. Whatever you can get by with is all right. I don't believe in that. I believe that you ought to have a background where what you do is right and not try to get by with something that's wrong just because you can get by with it.
Do you think that the Republicans are peculiarly and chronically conditioned not to be interested in all these problems that have to do with the plight of people?
Well, they have a viewpoint that's entirely different from the viewpoint of the welfare of the common people. They believe that there ought to be a ruling class. They believe that the welfare of the country can be handled from the top down. And the difference between them and us, as set out by Franklin Roosevelt, is that we believe that the welfare of the people starts from the bottom up. That's the only difference.
Well, now, isn't there a pretty large segment of the Democratic Party that feels the same way, let's say, about racial problems?
Oh, well, yes. As I said a while ago, both parties are cross-sectioned with people who believe one way and another. And there are, of course, some of the Democratic so-called aristocrats who believe in the Republican program, and they ought to join the Republican Party. I've always said that.
Now, we've slowed down a little bit legislatively now, and some of the progressive fire that has been built onto the Congress by Franklin Roosevelt and yourself seems to be dying down.
I don't think so, because the very fact that they made the president accept the bill that he vetoed shows that there are still enough good Democrats in the Congress to make that happen.
Well, I don't think one, the one out of 145, Mr. President.
Well, I know, but then you'll find that in every instance, a vast majority of the Congress was for overriding the veto. And this situation of veto by the president, not on principle, but on policy of a Republican administration, doesn't mean that that's what the majority of the people believe. You study the votes in the Congress, even on the vetoes, you'll find that there were vast majority on the side of the people. And the only reason that they didn't have enough for two-thirds is because some of our Southern Democrats and the Dixiecrats and the Shivercrats went along with the Republicans to uphold something that I thought and that the majority of the Democrats thought in the Congress was wrong.
Well, in that case, wherever the president has vetoed and has been sustained in his veto, that doesn't mean he's been sustained by the majority of the people.
Not at all. It means that he's been sustained by those who believe in special privilege, that's all.
In other words, sustained by a minority, because
that's
actually...
Right. A vast minority.
All you need is a third to support him.
You talk about a minority president, that's what he's been.
In that case, we are about to face another barrage of propaganda of peace and prosperity as the keynote and the sole possession and property of the Republican Party. How phony is that?
Entirely phony. All you have to do is to ask the farmer and the little businessman, and then you get the answer.
That's on prosperity. Now, they say, and they continue to say it, and they're going to say it again, that wars are always coincidental with Democratic administrations and are absent in the Republican ranks now.
How about Lincoln and McKinley?
Well, they that was there was a little bit of both, but how about since then?
It isn't true. The only reason in the world that we had to get into World War I and World War II was due to the fact that we were attacked and had to defend ourselves. And I'm not so much of the opinion that you ought to stand by and let yourself be slapped on both cheeks before you refuse to meet the situation with which you're faced, because eventually you're going to have to face it. And the fact that the two last world wars happened in Democratic administrations was by accident and not the intention of the Democrats. I wonder what the Republicans would have done in the case of Pearl Harbor when the Japanese murdered our youngsters without provocation and in peacetime. I wonder what would have happened after the sinking of the Lusitania and the very fact that they began to sink and take over our people off of ships that were peacefully inclined. Would the Republicans have stood for that? I don't think they would. They all voted for the declaration of war in each instance. I don't think there were but a very small minority against meeting the situation as it came up. And when it's just like talking about Korea as my war. Korea wasn't my war. Korea was an attempt to make the United Nations stand up, and we did, up until the time when the present administration surrendered to the communists after I'd gone out of office.
Well, now the present administration is also making a big, big drive for peace, almost at any cost, is it not, sir?
I don't believe in peace at any price, never have. I believe that the best thing to do is to be sure that liberty and freedom is maintained. And you'll find that some of the greatest philosophers in the country and in the world, in history, believe that freedom of action and liberty of the individual is much more important than peace at any price. And Nehru's found that out.
Well,
much to his regret, I think.
Well, Nehru's found it out, and Macmillan at this moment has taken his place, and he's out putting trade ahead of everything.
Trade, you know, has been the fundamental basis of the British economy, and they want trade, and I don't blame them for wanting trade, because they're a country that can't produce enough to live on, and they've got to have trade to make it work. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's right. I think in the long run, freedom and liberty are much more important than trade or anything else.
Well, is it fair to assume that the Democrats, because they're interested in the plight of the little man, businessman, etc., that they're also equally interested in the survival of little nations and little peoples who
That's the reason for their interest in the survival of these small nations. And of course, eventually those small nations, as was done after World War II in the organization of NATO, which put the free nations together, eventually those small nations will come to the point where they'll organize for their own protection, and then they'll be in a position to have a voice in the United Nations that'll count.
Mr. President, what do you feel about de Gaulle's insistence that France be allowed to be a sovereign nuclear power, in other words?
Well, whenever France proves that it can overcome what it did in the Second World War,